It's a conflict, but as they're closing mills right and left in the southeast, it's probably a non-issue. There's plenty of wood production potential in the southeast, and a large number of plantations in place now. Price of wood has, because of this development, has remained pretty much static for decades. And so the availability of woody biomass is probably not an issue. There are many examples of energy conversion facilities that are going into the southeast now.
The next speak.
Thank you.
I'm only going to do one question for you to try to get back on time here. So essentially, Mark had a statistical analysis of yields over a region, and now Peter Woodbury is going to give a talk on modeling. And I have a feeling that even though Peter is up in Cornell, where there are a lot of forests, that he will also probably talk about some herbaceous feedstocks. Is this correct?
It is.
Okay.
Peter Woodbury, Cornell.
Thanks, Tris. Well, thanks everybody for coming back after lunch. I guess we haven't solved all of the bioenergy problems this morning, so we have a little more work to do. We want a lot from our land. In agronomy circles, the food, feed, and fiber has been a mantra, and fuel being added to that fairly recently. And on the forest side, of course, there's always been a strong tradition of multi-use, multi-products. I think we have to acknowledge that there is conflict for land. And we have to think about how all these pieces are going to go together. So at the farm scale, we need to figure out how we're going to be producing fuel out of systems that are also producing food, feed, and fiber. How's that going to work? Well, I think one thing we need to do is think about it at different scales. So at the national scale, for strategic planning at the national level, we need to think about what are we doing with our land. So the issues of land use change, direct and indirect, come up. So certainly decision makers want answers at the national scale. And as has been referred to earlier, whether or not we are ready to provide them, decisions will get made. At the regional scale, there's also a lot of interest. Activities, research, and bioenergy development is going to be regional. It's going to be within states. And of course, it's really going to happen at the local scale. That's where the feedstocks are going to be grown and where decisions are going to be made. So I'm going to talk a little bit about each of these scales and refer you to some other work at this conference. So at the national scale and also at the regional scale, we're thinking about what land is out there and what's being done with it. On the forest side, a lot of work is being done right now on forest residues by Oak Ridge National Lab and the Forest Service. As Tris said, he knows I think about wood a lot, and I think it's really important. I'm not going to talk about it much today, but there are ongoing efforts to better quantify how much residue we can get out of forests sustainably. And in many parts of the country, that's going to be a dominant feedstock. On the non-forest land, we're thinking about sort of two broad categories of land. One is current cropland, and the other is herbaceous land that's not currently being cropped. So we're trying to begin to ask this question of how much land might there be available in these two categories. With the pasture, hay, and grassland, we started with a national land cover database, so satellite-derived estimates. We subtract out the land that's currently in production based on agricultural statistics from NAS. We also remove steeply sloping lands, and we've tried to remove smaller fields to try to get some of this land that's in very mixed use and is not likely to come into production off of the table. So here's what we come up with. Each dot is 10,000 acres. I apologize to any of you who, I'm going to do this whole thing in English units. So there's some funny patterns that we can see here. One thing we see is in a lot of parts of the country, this land is very scattered. Now these are dots representing chunks of 10,000 acres. So it's not, these are dots within a county. We see some real concentrations, of course, in some areas. We did remove federal land, so that's why there's a very interesting pattern in a lot of the western half of the country there. On the cropland, of course, there's a lot of concern about food versus fuel. And one way we tried to address that is, as everyone knows, there are ongoing trends in crop yields over time. So for maize, we're seeing a very steady increase over time in yields per acre. This is an example for New York State. You see similar trends in most other states. For some lower intensity crops like hay, we don't necessarily see a trend over time. So if you're not putting in more inputs, if you're not working on the genetics, and you're not necessarily going to see that increase. So we looked at 35 crops individually for each state and projected if we want to maintain 2007 production in the future, say 2020, with these trends in crop yield, how much land might be available to either grow more crops or sweet gum or any other feedstock you're interested in. I'm going to stop right there and see if that makes any sense. So we're projecting historical trends only if there was a strong linear trend in that state for that crop. And so here's a map of this potentially available cropland. Again, the idea is this is cropland. We can choose what we want to do with it, but we should be able to increase production of something on this land this is land that becomes available because we can increase production on the other portion of the cropland. Not surprisingly, it's where the cropland is. So we're seeing a big concentration in the upper Midwest. Okay, so we've identified at least at this 10,000 foot scale some land that's potentially available. How do we think about what we can produce on that? Again, at this very broad national or large regional scale. We've heard talks today about various modeling approaches. We've heard talks about both site-specific data and the lack of those data in many places. We don't have enough yield trial data to directly scale up. We also have to think about the issues that we've heard about going from a research plot to a real field. That's a scaling issue. We have to think about if we're really going to be serious about producing feedstocks, we're going to see large increases. And we've just heard about that from Bill about the, you know, with a serious amount of effort, you can get a serious amount of increased yield. So we just picked, we wanted to use existing soils data, and we wanted to make some projections of potential future feedstock yields. We focused on grasses. We're not being specific about what they are here. And we think about corn as a plant that we know a lot about how it grows. We have a lot of data on corn yield throughout much of the country. So we developed a regression based on soils data to predict corn yield at the scale of each county in the U.S. And we're using that to represent a high-intensity input feedstock. In other words, what we're saying is with enough effort, we should be able to get the same amount of biomass we get from corn out of switchgrass or willow or some of these other feedstocks. And we looked at hay yields as a low-intensity system. So again, we took soils data, looked at regressions of actual hay yields from NAS data across the country. So this is just an integrated index of soil and climate properties. This is under development by the NRCS, the National Commodity Crop Productivity Index. And this is a regression of current hay yields from agricultural statistical data against this rating. So we get a fairly good linear trend with an R-squared value of 0.64. And I'll make a plug for a poster by my colleague Zia Ahmed tomorrow. So from 4 to 6, you can see more about this in that poster. So then we can look at, for both a high and low intensity production system, what might we get looking at across the country, large regions of the country, for both cropland and herbaceous land. And the overall answer is there's a lot more of this herbaceous land. So at this 10,000 foot level, there's a lot more production potential there. Although the yields may be higher on cropland, there's going to be less of it available. On the south central portion of the country is really standing out, at least according to what we've come up with so far. Now I'm going to come down a little bit to the regional scale. This is still 14 states, so it's still quite a large region. Again, I just want to mention there are folks looking closely at logging residues and other thinnings. Want to keep that in mind. I'm going to back up for a moment because the dark green here is forest, so this is critical in the Northeast. We saw much less production potential in the previous slide for the Northeast than some of the other regions, and that's because we were looking at the herbaceous land. So again, thinking about current herbaceous land, here's a picture of that in the Northeast. So it's kind of the opposite of where the forest is. And here's just some example for individual states here. So again, Ohio's standing out in our kind of agricultural states in the Northeast. Ohio's the one with the most cropland as well as the most herbaceous land. So it has the highest production potential. At the state scale, we're doing some work that gets to be a little bit more involved, not as involved as that first diagram I showed you, where we're thinking at the farm scale, but we're thinking about increased milk yield per cow. That also is going to make some land available. There's a million acres of land devoted to pets called horses in New York State. Well, most of them are pets. Most of that is not on farms, so it's not going to show up in any agricultural statistical database. Those horses also are going to require feed, and they're going to require straw. And so as we get down to this more detailed level, we can bring some of the more state-scale knowledge in. And so this is just showing a trend in milk production in New York State. So the red dots are the milk produced per cow per year, and it's really quite an amazing trend, and this occurs in any dairy state, very similar trend. The blue line is the number of cows, so that is decreasing substantially over time. And the black is the sum of those. So the total milk production is fairly stable right now. And the folks that I work with expect that to continue into the future. There's not going to be a market for increased amounts of milk. Again, this is something that can free up quite a bit of land. When you get more milk per cow, you're increasing the efficiency of that. It takes less feed for the amount of milk that you get. So less land is required. We've heard some talk about trying to get at costs. That's going to be critical, and as we all, this is just showing a predicted cost of warm season grass production in New York. And as anyone who's looked at this will know, as the yield goes up, the cost per ton is going down. So at the New York scale, we've been able to put together these response curves. showing the production cost on the bottom scale and the total production on the vertical axis. So hardwood and willow, short rotation willow, are coming in first at the lowest predicted cost per ton and ramping up steeply there. Grasses are coming in a bit later, higher cost per ton, ending up with a similar amount of production potential. So the grass and the willow would be competing for largely the same land. And the left half of this graph shows current forest and agricultural production. Everything's on units of dry tons, just so we can compare things, so we can literally compare apples and oranges or trees and apples and corn here. The idea is just, the right half of this graph shows potential additional bioenergy production. So basically, we are projecting that it's possible to double total production in New York State by using additional land. And that would include both forests on the forest side, as well as grass and willow on herbaceous land. I'm not going to say too much about greenhouse gases. I encourage you to come to a talk by my colleague Jenny Whiteman, who's sitting in the back tomorrow. What time's your talk, Jenny? Okay. She'll be talking about a little bit more about greenhouse gas emissions in New York State. I'll just quickly say that the grasses and willow have less emission. So here we're looking at the emissions from the cradle all the way up to the farm gate. The black bars, the gray bars are without land use change, and the black bars are with land use change. And the land use change in this case is just the direct change of starting with of land that was in annual crop production and putting perennials on it. So we're predicting increased sequestration of carbon in roots, and that's going to actually reduce the total greenhouse gas emissions. Grasses look better than willow here when you bring that in. That's not because grasses actually store more carbon below ground, but because in the modeling that we did, the grasses are showing up primarily on, the grasses are more likely to occur on the annual cropland than the willow is. So the willow tends to be going on land that's already in perennial cover. Looks like I'm close?
1 minute.
Okay. At the local scale, I don't know if Hillary's back here, this is her photograph. So these are trials of different warm season grasses. A lot of work's going on. This is just the ones that we're aware of and have been able to map field trials for everything from canola to poplar and willow here. You've seen some pictures of impressive willow growth. And here, this is Jeff Malconian's work. He's also sitting in the audience today. This is just to say, when we get down to a specific site, we have site-specific data. We use a dynamic simulation model. We can do a better job predicting yield than we can at this 10,000-foot level. So that's this multi-scale point. The challenge, of course, is we don't have those site-specific data everywhere. Even if we do, it may be challenging to run the model at all the sites. But what we need to work on is making these connections between the scales so that we have useful answers at the larger scales, rooted in the actual data from specific sites. I'll just leave this up there and say two words about it, which is not everybody's going to want to produce bioenergy feedstocks, even if we think their land isn't being used for crops right now. On the other hand, a lot of folks in New York, at least, who have this idle, quote-unquote idle land, manage it by mowing. So some of those folks might be willing to have something there that gets mowed and taken away. The point is, we have to think about this kind of social filter. And again, back to my original slide, how's this going to actually fit into an enterprise or a landowner's goals? And I'll stop right there. I don't know if I have time left for questions.
Thanks, Peter.
Maybe one question while we're setting up for the next speaker.
Yes. Have there been any attempts to model if a high percentage of land that was idle was put into production?